So they say if you fixate on the thing you don't want to hit, you are going to hit it. So don't do that. So you want to keep it in your periphery, acknowledge it's there, acknowledge the risk, and then look through the turn to where you actually want to go.
Welcome back to Work is Third. I'm your host, Dawn Hunter, and I'm so glad you're here. Today's conversation is about what happens when everything changes and you still have to find a way forward. My guest, Paula Thomas, is a founder and storyteller who is learning out loud about work. After navigating crippling depression, building a career as a software engineer, and then losing her husband unexpectedly, Paula has learned to look through the turn to where she wants to be in life. We talk about small wins, celebration, and designing work that actually makes room for real life. Let's listen in.
Hello, Paula, and welcome to Work is Third.
Thanks for having me.
One of the reasons I'm glad you're here is that when we first chatted, there were so many topics that you proposed discussing that are so aligned with themes that have come up on Work is Third, including uncertainty and discomfort, going through transitions, and neurodivergence, among other things. Before we dive into any specific topic, I would love if you can share a word to describe how you're doing today.
Yeah. So it's funny because how I'm feeling today is content, which feels kind of like a funny thing to feel today because I just came off of like a whole marathon of trade shows and events and networking things. I have another one next week and I'm transitioning into a whole bunch of other stuff. So it's been so much chaos, but like kind of today I kind of just created that space in the middle of it and like focusing on the gratitude of like what I did over the last few months, what we accomplished, what I'm making and what we're doing next. And it's kind of just that energy of being really excited of like, I don't know where things are going to go, but I'm still really proud of what I'm doing. And it's really cool to be where I am right now. So yeah, I'm feeling like content and excited.
Content is a great word. I heard you say gratitude as well, which is also beautiful. It struck me that you talked about creating space in the chaos and taking a moment to appreciate all that you've done, because I don't think we often do that, right? I don't know that people often pause and say, I really had a great month and here's all the amazing things that I did. But it sounds like you did that.
Yeah. And I feel like it's absolutely a skill. Like it's definitely not something that ever came naturally to me. I'm always the one like in the middle of the chaos, like this needs to be done. This needs to be done. There's not time for gratitude. There's not time to relax. Like I just need to go, 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 go. But my late husband, he was very good. Like we were military, so we moved around a lot. Everything was unpredictable and I would get all spun up in it. And he was very good at being like, let's just stop and just go get dinner. Let's just stop and do this. Like no matter how crazy things got, he was really good at cutting through that noise. And honestly, just like training me over the years and getting that mindset and getting that like that level of like detecting how stressed I'm getting and then just kind of pulling the plug on it. Like you can never completely pull the plug, but just making an intentional choice of this is the time and the place to focus on something different. And so that's also something where like, you know, talking about gratitude, I'm grateful I could even like feel that and have that skill and be able to do that in the middle of the chaos, because it's such a important revitalization to then be ready to go into the next thing. I don't know what I'd do without it.
Right. But it is a practice that you have to develop, right? It's not something that we're taught necessarily to do. Growing up, or certainly even if we're because of faith or because of cultural traditions that we're taught gratitude practices, I think as we get older and we get into our lives, we sometimes let those fall by the wayside.
Yeah, because I remember early on, like I would argue with him a lot. And the argument that would come up is I can't because, you know, like from a cultural perspective, I can't because work needs this or family needs this, or like there's so many expectations of all these things that need to be done. And he would just be like, why? And I'd have a whole bunch of whys and he would just, why? And he would just kind of like with a little kid where you're just very persistent and you just keep asking the same question until eventually all the excuses run out and then go, okay, I guess you're right. I guess the world won't explode if I sit down for like 5 minutes. Like, okay.
There are two pieces of it that are important. And the first is giving yourself permission to take a break. But then Yes. The second is actively acknowledging that taking that break was good for you.
Yes, for sure. Because if you don't feel like it was good for you, you're not going to do it again. Like you have to, like work is, I think is a good example, because I know for me, it would be like, I can't because it'll detract from work. It'll put me back. It'll hurt my productivity. But then when I take those breaks and I really, really like cut off from my computer, all of that, like walk outside and then come back, and then like I work for a bit, then I acknowledge I actually came back way more refreshed and came up with a new solution to the problem, went through it a lot faster. And the only reason that went so well was because I took the break. So like you said, acknowledging that reward then makes me want to take more breaks because I'm like, I want to do better at work. So to do better, I need to stop.
And so you have these two things you do. You have both your manufacturing and your personal brand. I'd love to just dive into how you're balancing that and how long you've been doing both of those things. I guess let's start there. And then how do you manage that? Because, you know, you mentioned the word chaos, and I'm curious, like, does it create a lot of chaos for you that you have to manage?
It's funny because kind of on the quote unquote back end, for me, it's all the same. It's all interwoven. It's how I approach everything. It's what I do. But then externally, I have to acknowledge that I'm talking to very different audiences. So like when I'm talking to customers about the products and what we manufacture, they are curious about how the products help them. But then when I'm talking about emotional intelligence and stuff, there's other audiences that specifically want to talk about those things. But then when I'm talking with my co-founders, you know, we're having our weekly meeting talking about what we're producing here, what ideas we're pursuing. And it's all kind of mixed in with that of like, oh, yeah, I didn't get this done because I took a self-care break or a day to do this. Or my co-founders are also family. So then again, that's all interwoven where we're open to talk about the personal things and the business things.
Makes sense, right? I think I encounter that too. And then I have worked full-time like in a W-2 job for 20-ish years. But then when I started doing more consulting and speaking on the side, I started having to explain to different audiences what I was doing. And actually, that was a challenge for me. I'm not going to lie. Just it's like, it's similar, but it's not the same. Yeah, it was a challenge, but it's become more clear over time.
Yeah, that was a huge challenge for me too. And it's funny, moving around with military life, I was kind of forced into a lot of career changes because this was before work from home was really popular and all of that. And so I learned a little bit about myself and like some of my entrepreneurial spirit, but I also learned like how hard it is to explain things sometimes and how important networking is. So when I started this venture, even though like on the surface, it's like manufacturing and it's very design heavy and very like technical. Right away, I knew I needed to sign up for networking groups, one, to get practice because I'd been a software engineer for 5 years and I was like not in the habit of like talking to people again. I was like, I need to do this more. But also just to practice my spiel and who I am and what my business is and kind of just get out there and just talk to people. Like even early on when we didn't really know what our product would be, we didn't know a lot of stuff. It was like, I would just go to these meetings anyway and kind of figure it out as I went, figure out what resonates with people, how, you know, you see all these classes that say, this is how you should pitch yourself or this is how you should do it. But then sometimes when you get that out and start practicing, it's like, that doesn't resonate with me or I can't quite deliver that well. Or they say, tell a joke. And I realize I'm very bad at telling jokes. Maybe I shouldn't do that.
It's really a great piece of advice. I mean that genuinely because I had a supervisor once who I was asking him for advice, like on a presentation that I was working on. And he said, just talk about something that excites you. And
yeah,
it's really honestly so simple, but it is the best advice because the things that you care the most about are easiest for you to talk about. And I feel like if you're listening to your body or you're listening to yourself and you're struggling to articulate something, then to me, that's a sign that it doesn't come naturally to you. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it. It just means like, this is not something you know, is innate that you're, you know, really maybe strongly connected with. And you got to take a step back, I think, in those situations.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause that was something I noticed when I went to these networking groups and I'm pitching what I do. And, you know, I had the spiel that I worked out with like ChatGPT and all the things I learned in my classes of like, this is what people want and this is how you should do it. And I'd start to get that spiel and people would kind of get confused and I kind of feel their energy kind of pull back. And then one person asked a question that kind of got me on a roll and I started talking about why 3D printing, why I'm excited about it, how, you know, for me, a lot of why I'm drawn to it is because I am very technical and I like the software aspect of iterating quickly. But I grew up around machinery and I love, you know, tactical things and holding something at the end of the day. So I love how 3D printing brings both together and I can really explore them in a new way. And as soon as I talked about it like that, she started leaning in and I was like, oh, this went really well. So the next few conversations, I started kind of segueing into that. And I was worried because all of the advice said, your customers don't care that it's 3D printed. They care about the product, not the process, and you're going to confuse them. But since I was so passionate about it, I got a lot, like people still didn't quite understand the concept of 3D printing sometimes, but they saw the energy and that brought them to ask questions and get engaged in the conversation. Then we could get to a really good place and a really good conversation. So yeah, like you said, that energy and that excitement makes a huge difference. And you're only going to find out with practice.
You only find out with practice. Yeah. And being able to build those connections too, right? I mean, business is very much about relationships. And if people feel like they can connect with you as a human being, then they're more likely to be interested in your product and interested in what it is that you have to say. And those are like really important lessons to learn, especially when you're doing your own thing.
Exactly. And that was one thing that used to make me very nervous going into networking events is, like you said, it's very important. You got to make first impressions. You got to, like, my whole business rides on these connections. And then I would be even more nervous about doing it right. But then I realized there's a lot of psychology and there's a lot of quotes that say people won't remember what you said. They'll remember how you made them feel. And it's so true, especially at a networking event. Like, I used to always have a rule because I'm very introverted and I also was recently diagnosed. I'm autistic. So I have a hard time reading social structures. I have a hard time without like a structured set of rules. And so networking events were my worst nightmare. So I would go in with a rule of, okay, I just need to talk to three people and I'll leave. Like that's my, I can pull the ripcord. I can get out. I usually ended up spending way longer than that because once I got past the three, it kind of snowballed and it went well. So that fear of doing things right and getting things like getting my spiel perfect, making a good first impression, I learned not to fear that and to just focus on rolling with the flow, rolling with how things feel. If I get my pitch wrong, I can always try again later, like because you end up pitching to people multiple times. Like they'll forget all the flops. They'll forget all the technical things that like just focus on the conversation and what feels good in the moment and go with that.
When I go to networking events and conferences, one of the things that I think I do very intentionally, but almost do it like subconsciously, is not talk about work. Cause I'm like, we're going to be talking about work for like 2.5 days straight. And so when I talk to people, I try to intentionally talk about other things, but it also helps me to remember when I meet new people, because I can always write down on your business card what we connect, like what you do or why we were talking to each other. But I really want to remember, why did I feel like I wanted to connect with you after I left here? Do you do something like that?
It's funny because with my social anxiety, I have this very irrational fear of asking anything personal, like, because, you know, there's always these sitcoms where like you ask an innocent question about the weather and then that turns into, oh, it was raining the day my dog died. Now you just reminded me of the, like this whole cascade. So I have like this fear in my brain of something like that. And so and I'm also very analytical. So I like the structure of asking about the business side first, because I know that routine and I know I'm in a networking event. It's expected I ask these questions. But once the conversation starts and people, you know, ask personal questions, I actually love that because I see it like once somebody asks me a question, I'm like, okay, this is safe to ask now. Now I can ask it back because I really do want to learn. I want to know how people are doing. I want to know what's going on with their life. I want to know if they have dogs. Like I want to like see all the pictures. And so I love those conversations. So once somebody kind of broaches that topic, I love it because like you said, then you can really connect on a deeper level and know kind of like where you're at. And then you can always go to their website later and learn about their business.
Well, I'm curious about how you ended up doing what you're doing now. And the question I wanted to ask is, you mentioned that your late husband was in the military, so you had to move. I grew up in the military, which we talked about before. And you're right, before work from home, it would be really challenging to be a military spouse and have to make a change in your own career. And I'm just curious if that is something that led you to doing what you're doing now, or if not related at all.
Yeah, like it all definitely ties together. So it'll be a bit of a long answer, so feel free to interrupt at any point. But for me, yeah, throughout all those career changes, I would always have a spell of, like you said, like a normal like 9-to-5 job. And I would do really well at those, but I would always hit a point of burnout. And then it was funny because then after the burnout, I'd have a period of what I like to call just like entrepreneurship. Like I did my own YouTube page for a while, or I wrote a book, or I would do these other or projects or work with startups. And that always revitalized me. That always gave me avenues to pursue creative things, to pursue the business side of things, to really get into the nitty gritty of like how things work, how you connect with people, how you make something that people want. But then it was like, okay, now we moved. Now I'm going to go back to a normal job. So there's this ebb and flow. But I always knew that like entrepreneurial things were what really like brought me energy. And so for context, because I feel this is relevant, almost 3 years ago, my husband passed away suddenly. It was a motorcycle accident, not expected at all. It was instant. And obviously that brought about a lot of chaos. And part of, like you said, like the learning out loud was for me, I've always been very talkative. And so when I'm processing things, especially something like grief and everything that goes with it, I would just talk about it. Like I had my family here, I had friends here, and I would just talk about how I was feeling. Also, partially because that's how I process it, but also because I know when people are worried about you, they don't know how you feel or what you want unless you tell them. And so that's really hard to do. So I was trying to be very intentional about that habit because I knew they were so worried about me, and I needed them to take care of themselves. And the only way they could give themselves permission to take care of themselves was if I told them how I was feeling. So I was doing this learning out loud. And as I went back in the world and went back to work, I would run into strangers, you know, at the office or commuting, and it would come up and we'd talk about it. One person I ended up like having dinner with, and we talked about it for hours, and I drove her to the airport. And these conversations, it kept coming up where even if they weren't going through grief, even if they were going through something else, they'd be like, wow, like I learned so much from this. And like, I appreciate you being open, because people aren't open about a lot of these things. And hearing you say this and hearing you talk about it has given me a new way to think about it, has given me something to take home and work on. And so I don't want to be selfish and think that like what I have to say will help everyone, but I figure, you know, if it's helping somebody, I might as well keep blabbing and see what people take from it. So as long as it's being helpful, I want to be helpful. So yes, that's where the personal brand came from, was doing that, because I definitely want to pay that forward. And then Vitium Manufacturing came about because I was doing that 9-to-5 software engineer, all of that. But like I said, that's always historically been very draining and burnout for me. And there was a lot of changes neurologically going on. And eventually I hit a point where I was like, I need to step away from this and do something entrepreneurial again. I really want to explore everything I've learned and put it into practice and see what I can make with it. If doing so many of those jobs, I've learned so much about myself, what my strengths are, what I like doing, what I don't like doing. How can I culminate all of this and use this energy and see where it goes and see where life takes me? So yeah, that's kind of how those two branched out.
Well, I want to start by saying that I am sorry for the loss of your husband and deeply appreciate you being willing to share your story, but also recognize that what you're saying is it's a part of the work that you are doing and the purpose that you are serving now in a way that you pay it forward and help others. So I just want to start with saying I appreciate that. And also, I do think it is important, like you said, to be able to create a space where people can feel safe sharing how they're feeling and what's going on with them. And actually, you said something when we first started talking about being in a meeting and people saying, oh, I was taking a break because I was doing self-care or whatever. It's so important to create spaces, especially at work, where we normalize saying, I was being a human being. This is why I did not do this thing, or this is why I had to make a change, or whatever the reason, whatever the thing is that you're trying to explain. And we are human beings first. And I know that's something that's important to you as well.
Yeah, for sure. And that was something like when I was at Amazon, they had a lot of great resources and a lot of great groups. And one of them was this emotional intelligence community where they'd share all sorts of research and articles and interviews. And it was a very great group. But then it was interesting, this contrast of learning all of that and then going to my team. And I had a very great team and they were all like very kind and supportive. But then the culture was different. And so bringing something into that culture, people would listen and they would kind of work with me on stuff. But culture is something that's very hard to shift. You can't just like walk in as like the mid-level engineer and just change everybody's minds on how things work. It's something that's like ingrained from like the beginning of a team. And so a a lot of what I'm fascinated with about starting my own business is figuring out this balance of, okay, we've learned a lot about emotional intelligence and work-life balance and all of this study. What does it look like to build a company from the ground up with that in mind? Because there's always this tension between making money versus making things flexible. And that was something that struck me when my husband passed. There were a lot of family members, like very close family members, who struggled to make time for like things like the funeral or to come over, like all these big, big important moments, because they were like the only one at work who could do their job, or so many people depended on them, or their PTO was very tightly limited and restricted. So it was like a battle to get like 1 to 2 days off just for something that's important. And so to my mind, just like the name of this podcast, work is third. Like if somebody in your family like disappears off the face of the planet, you should be able to disappear from work and go handle that. Like this, no questions asked, you should be able to just drop out. And the business should be able to figure out how to operate around that. And I think it's a lot of it too, because I like thinking of it from both sides, because you also have to be practical of like, you have to run a business. You can't just, the money doesn't last forever. But like from a practical perspective, it's a win-win for the business too, because when you focus on these elements that make your company robust enough to handle somebody taking care of their life, you're also making it robust enough to handle whatever business throws at you. It's there's nothing bad about doing this. So it's like, let's put it into practice and let's try it. Let's show people what it looks like. So yeah.
So many words of wisdom there. I'm just over here, if for people who are just listening and not watching the video, I'm just like clapping and smiling and just loving everything that you're saying, Paula. But it's important because as you're talking, I was thinking, on the one hand, I think it's incumbent on us as people, as individuals, to assert our own boundaries and say, I need this time off. I need to take care of myself. I experienced a loss and I need to be able to process that and grieve that in the way that works for me. But the bigger picture issue is that the system needs to change to recognize that your employee base is a bunch of human beings who are experiencing all kinds of things. And being able to allow them to be human and take care of themselves does allow them to show up better for your business, as you were saying. It makes your business more robust.
Exactly. But
the best thing that you said, I think, is what if we just built a better way to work in the first place? Like, what if we just built it right from the ground up?
Yeah, because that's another thing is my undergraduate degree, I actually have a bachelor's in sociocultural anthropology. So a lot of it is understanding sociology, psychology, culture, and all of the nuance of how that comes together. And the funny thing is, when it comes to culture and it comes to systems, you can't just go in and change it. That's not how they work. Like, there's so many things that build up over time that then by the time we realize there's a problem, it's a battle. It might not even be possible to change it at that point, depending on how deeply ingrained it is. So it's funny because at these meetings with my founders, sometimes I'll be implementing a process or implementing a habit or a pattern. And they're like, why are we doing this? We don't have employees yet. And I'm like, we need to practice this habit now, because by the time we have employees, we're going to be too busy. It's going to be too late. We're not going to have any understanding what we're doing. Let's start now, establish this as our culture, and get practice with it and learn what works and what doesn't. And that way, later when we do start hiring people, it's just a thing we do. Like, we want it to be something we breathe, because if it's too difficult, it's not going to get done.
Right. It's harder to change while you're in the middle of it. And I remember we talked about this when we first connected, is like putting the systems in place before you need them.
Exactly. Because by the time you need them, you're going to be in a state of overwhelm. And the way our brains work is we can only handle a limited number of things at a time. So if you're like procrastinating all this stuff for when we're successful, we'll do this. When we're successful, we'll do that. Now, not only does the success give you all of this work, but now you have all this other work that you procrastinated on top of it. And that's not sustainable. And that's when people then default to just this. And that's when all of the rest goes by the wayside. That's when mistakes happen. That's when bad culture takes root. So it's like, if we can take all of this and gradually put it out over here and just do little bits at a time, then by the time we get to the successful whatever it is, cool. Now we can hit the ground running and we can knock it all out and we can just go with it, because it's what we do. It's what we practiced.
Can we walk through for a moment like what this looks like with the example that you were sharing with grief and loss and the difficulty of people who were in your extended circle who couldn't take time off of work or couldn't make it to the funeral? Because this is, to me, one of the areas of our society that I struggle with the most, because we don't create our lives recognizing grief and loss. So when it happens, it can be catastrophic in so many ways. And, you know, I really loathe the fact that there are people who, you know, a friend of mine, her father passed away unexpectedly, and that she had, you know, like 3 days of bereavement leave.
Yeah. When I took my 2 months off, it was completely unpaid. Like, they paid for 5 days. And it was like, okay, this is what I need to do. And that's wild to me, because you can't, like, something that fundamentally and that big, like, doesn't just check a box in 3 days and go back to work. That's not how the brain works. And a lot of what informs how I think about this was, so my late husband was in submarines. And so a lot of how they build their systems and structures is, you know, prepared for catastrophic events. Like, if something happens to the submarine, if something happens here, they build it around the possibility of, if somebody was to, like, drop and, like, have to go to the hospital, not be available to do their job, who's going to step in and take that? So they build with the mindset in mind that any of us could go down at any moment. But that then creates a more robust system, because now everybody's learning each other's jobs. And so now everybody can cover for it. Because I feel like a big reason why people can't leave, or can't leave for long, or why managers panic and are scared to let them leave, is because when one person is doing their job for so long and they get so much knowledge of their role, and then they leave and everybody realizes, oh, we don't know how to do this person's job, or we didn't realize how hard it is, or we didn't know the nuance of all of these client relationships. And then everything kind of scrambles and panics. And then it's like, you're hoping for them to come back because that wasn't prepared for. But I like this military concept of what they called, like, qualification cards, where you learn how to do each other's jobs, so that when somebody leaves, you kind of get practice beforehand. And then when they leave, you step in and you just do it, because you've already done it before. You've already planned for the unexpected. And I think the funny thing about how we run businesses today is we build our employee systems around things being stable and expected. And it's like, that's not how we work. That's not how any of this works. Like, even before my husband passed, my first job out of college, we had somebody who'd been at the company for like 20 years. And she was really good at what she did, and she was on top of it, and she was super healthy. And then Monday, she got flu-like symptoms. And this was years before COVID. By Friday, she was gone. And everybody was scrambling. It took the entire department to figure out how to take over her clients. And we just weren't prepared for it. There's no signs. There was no anything that this was coming. And it took us 6 to 8 months to even get caught up with her clients, because she was so good at what she did. And people didn't realize she was doing 10 times the work of the average person in her position. So yeah, it doesn't need to be a big pandemic. It could be any day. So we should expect the unexpected and stop building systems that pretend like everything is going to be predictable.
I think that's a great point, that we should build businesses expecting change, expecting the unexpected. But the other thing I was thinking is that I feel like we're incentivized for people to achieve and to be experts. And that's how we promote people. We make decisions based on how well you do at your job, you know, how successful you are at meeting metrics, et cetera. And so in some ways, we're saying we want people to specialize so much that we create that problem for ourselves.
Yeah. And it creates an interesting tension, too, because this is definitely something I'm still experimenting on the back end and coming up with ideas with. But a lot of these concepts come down to, like you said, like those performance metrics that we promote on, because as humans, when we're in a job, we want some way to prove that we are doing well. We want some way to prove that we can do better and get more pay. So then it becomes this question of, how do we give people room to grow? How do we measure that growth so we know when and how to reward it? But then that natural tension for growth then creates these systems of wanting to measure everything and approve everything. And then that serves in, like, pipes into a negative loop of, now we're measuring too much. Now we're being too nitpicky. Now you can only get promoted if we can measure the exact thing that you're good at, which a lot of impact is not cleanly measurable. There's too many factors. And so it's this tension between measurability and recognition versus, like, freedom and flexibility. And how do you reward people without making the metrics become the system?
I think about this a lot. I've spent most of my career in leadership roles and worked in different systems with different kinds of, you know, recognition and employee recognition programs. I don't know that there is, like, a a solid solution, right? Like, you want to make sure you're recognizing the people who are achieving things that are in alignment with whatever your business is trying to achieve, but you also don't want to be metric heavy.
Yeah. And that's also where another concept I've been playing with that ties into something we were talking about earlier is having people learn each other's jobs, but that can also tie into measuring performance as well. Because one thing I've learned across all the careers I've worked in is, especially if it's not something visual, like if it's something visual where you're like packing a box, people can look over your shoulder and see what you're doing. But if it's something not tactical or not tangible, like admin work or software engineering work, where you're in a computer and people can't see how much work you're doing, it becomes a lot harder to measure what they're doing. And as humans, we're very negatively biased. So then we stop seeing all the good we're doing. We stop seeing how much we need to celebrate. So then the funny thing is, if you start training somebody else to do your job and start practicing like incentivizing leaving frequently so that they're forced to do your job and they're forced to get better at it, that's usually the moment where all those little details, all the things you forgot that you do, as soon as you're gone and they're doing it, they're like, oh, wait, I didn't realize they're doing this. I didn't realize they're doing 10 of that. I didn't realize they're doing 20 of this. Now you suddenly have a much bigger picture of the value that person brings. And now as an outsider, you can then communicate that to the rest of your team or to your management of like, hey, this person is doing a lot of work and we should recognize this. So it's building resilience, but it's also rewarding the work that we're blind to and the value that we don't see every day.
Such a great idea. And you remind me, well, because you also said the word celebrate, that you made me think we don't celebrate enough. Like, we report because we're saying we made the widgets or we, you know, did the things, but we don't report and say, I want to recognize so-and-so because they had this amazing week, or they had an amazing day, or they really knocked this out of the park. And I think there are organizations and teams and leaders and people who do that really well. But I think you also have to be innovative. And one of the things I was thinking, I think it's on my desk. In an old team that I used to manage, we had a team trophy. And the trophy, you could award it to anyone else on the team. You kept it for the week. You could award it to anyone else after your week was up. Whatever reason, you wanted to recognize one of your coworkers for something. The only rule we had was, I said, you couldn't give it to me as the person who was leading the team. I just didn't feel like that was fair. And then when you got the trophy, you could add your own little swag to it. And so it just became like highly decorated over time. And it became a fun thing. And I always remember that. And then we tried different variations of that, or other kinds of ways of employees recognizing each other. Because you're right, we don't always see everything that people are doing. And we don't always recognize the value that people bring that's not on paper.
Yeah. And it's also tricky too, because like, I love award systems like that and incentivizing and making it fun. But then it's also tricky because being in software, I worked with a lot of people who aren't very socially skilled or don't have a lot of speaking experience, or maybe are shy about talking about themselves and their value. They would rather talk about everyone else. And so then if you have too much of that in a team, it starts to become where the award bounces around the people who are the most visible and the people who are the most like skilled at being vocal. And so if somebody doesn't have the skill set to talk about themselves, or if the work they do isn't highly visible, but it's like secretly holding the whole building up, it's like, how do we bring those folks into the sunlight? And at first, when I'd be mentoring people, I would try to coach them on like, you know, have a win book, talk about your wins, talk about your celebration. But that is a skill that takes time to develop. And sometimes people don't have time because they're so busy working or they're very reluctant. And so again, it's like, how can we bring other people in to see the full depth of what you do? Let's all build this skill set together, because when you're not talking about yourself, it's a lot easier to talk about this person that I just covered for while they're on vacation. And yeah, it may have been frustrating and all these things blew up, but now I understand how much work they do. And I'm so grateful they're back, and I'm so grateful they're on this team, and we should keep them and we should like promote them because we don't want this person to go. They're amazing.
Right. It's a blend of these different practices and things that we've been talking about, like you said, where you're doing cross training, where people are building these multiple skill sets, where we also are creating a culture where people feel comfortable recognizing each other and celebrating each other. And I also heard you say a win book.
Yeah.
Tell me more about this win book idea.
Yeah. So, actually, the way my mentors used to call it was a brag book, because the way we did promotions on a lot of my teams was we actually wrote our own promo docs. And so then when it came time to write it, it was like, what did I do? I don't remember. I don't know. Like, it was this weird thing of like, I know I deserve the promotion, but I can't quite articulate it. So my mentors would say, like, keep a brag book. And they even did this in the military too. And so it was every time you do something worth celebrating, even if it's small, but even if it's big, whatever it is, write it down as it happens before you can forget. And then like at the end of the quarter or the end of the year, when you're sitting down to like write this document or trying to talk to about a promotion or move, all you have to do is reference this document and go, oh yeah, I forgot I did this. I forgot I did that. And then it's just a matter of copy paste and pull it in and organize it. And then there you go. But again, that's a skill. And I know for a lot of us, it feels really awkward. It feels really like vain and egocentric. And it's like, I don't want to do this. This feels weird. It's like, but it's so important, because if we can't celebrate ourselves, then it's hard for other people to, because they don't know what to celebrate.
This is such a great piece of advice for everyone. It's actually something that I think all employees should do. Keep a list of your accomplishments. Keep a running list of all the great things you do, and not just I got published or I got this award or I did this podcast or I was whatever. It can be small things too. If you feel like it was an accomplishment, write it down.
Yeah. Like I loved an example. I don't remember if it was in the episode with Rashida. But I remember one of you said, you know, I took a nap at a time where I normally wouldn't give myself permission to take a nap. Let's celebrate that. I was like, that is so great and so true, because even the personal stuff, it's like, it's so easy to punish ourselves for something we need. It's like, no, let's celebrate that. Like, that is something you need. That is something that is energizing you. We should all make an intentional act to celebrate, because on a psychological level, we are wired to default to the negative and to find the bad things and find the things we did wrong and try to fix it. And it's part of what motivates us to keep growing and keep doing things. And it's a great thing. But that also means we have to be intentional and build the skill set to also look at the rest of the picture, also look at the good things, and then pull those in as well, so that you're looking at the whole picture and not just this one dark corner.
I talk about this a lot in the context of communication, and how our brains are drawn to negative, like we have a negativity bias, right? As you're describing. And that goes in all aspects of our life. I love that you're lifting up being intentional. One of the ways I do that is I started journaling practice. Well, I've been journaling on and off for years, but I started a morning pages practice about a year and a half ago. And in that, I try to at least once a week or a couple times a week recognize when I feel like I need to give myself some kudos. For whatever it is, it's a good habit to be in, to even do it in your personal life, because then you can also take that into places that you work, play, worship, wherever you are, any spaces you operate in, then you're taking that practice into all those other spaces.
Exactly. Yeah. And these skills and like having control over where you focus drives so much of then where we go. So for me, like I rode motorcycles for years and, you know, I took the classes and my late husband and I would very much geek out about the safety of it and how things work and the psychology of it. And one concept that comes up a lot in motorcycles is what they call looking through the turn. So if you are about to make a turn, or if there's a hazard in the road, like there's a pothole or there's a wall, and you see these hazards, or you're worried about like the angle, and you start to panic when you start to look at that, like, I don't want to hit that pothole. I don't want to hit that pothole. They call that a target fixation. And since motorcycles are so sensitive to where your body leans, even your head is like 10 pounds. So even just the way you look, the bike will follow. So they say, if you fixate on the thing you don't want to hit, you are going to hit it. So don't do that. Like, you still have to acknowledge it's there. You still have to know it's there, because if you don't pay attention to where it is, you're going to hit it. So you want to keep it in your periphery, acknowledge it's there, acknowledge the risk, and then look through the turn to where you actually want to go. Because your bike and your body and your instincts will follow where you're looking, follow your intention. So that was something where, when I was going through my grief journey, you know, there's all that impulse to want to be self-destructive, to want to go in a dark corner, to want to isolate from family and friends. But I'd gone through some really bad depression before, and I'd seen where that led, and it took me years to get back out. And I was like, the last thing I need right now is to make this bad situation worse. So then that ended up becoming my mantra of look through the turn, look at where I want to go. You know, it's like, okay, there's like this hazard. I don't want to do this, but this is where I'm going to go. And I'm going to acknowledge everything. I'm going to keep it present, keep it in my periphery, but I'm going to look at, my goal is to get out of the house by the end of the week. I'm going to build up my skills to like step out of this house and not self-combust. So yeah, it's such a hard skill, but it's so valuable, because then once you're oriented that way, everything clicks into place and things that you thought you couldn't do suddenly start rolling in the right direction. And it's amazing to see it in practice.
That's a great metaphor for how to manage those difficult situations. As I was also, when I was younger, went through a period of severe depression. And part of what got me out of that was, like you said, in some ways, like taking these baby steps, acknowledging that right now I feel terrible, I'm struggling to do X, Y, and Z, I still can try to work toward this thing. And also recognizing, like, you got to give yourself grace if it doesn't work out too.
Yeah. And that was a big thing too, because I know with some of my early like depression and anxiety, when I reached a point where I was ready to start going back into the workforce again, I knew, because I didn't know at the time, but like I have autism. So I was actually very sensitive to sound, to social situations. I was very easily overstimulated. But even without the diagnosis, I knew this about myself. So I knew going back to the office full time was going to be hard. So while I was applying for jobs, that was actually something I did to try to practice, was there was a networking group in like a hobby that I really liked. And so my goal was to go once a month, talk to three people, and I could leave. Like, even if it only took me 15 minutes to talk to people, I could leave. And like I said earlier, a lot of times I ended up talking for a long time. And other times I did just stay there for 30 minutes and left, which, you know, felt like a big waste because it was such a long trip to get there and get back. But that was what I needed. And that kept the momentum. And at that, like early on, I would come back from that. And even if it was a great experience, it would take me like a week to recover because it was just so exhausting for me because I wasn't used to that. But by the end, I actually became the group's like partner relations manager. I was going to other events for them. I was networking for them. I was helping out the vendors, because that practice and just keeping myself accountable, giving myself permission to walk away, but still expecting myself to show up, eventually built up to a point where then I was able to go to the office 5 days a week and talk to people. So yeah, it's really rewarding to kind of be intentional about creating those spaces. And like you said, be forgiving of like, I can just walk away after 15 minutes. Like, that space is what helps the habit stick and helps you actually see it through.
Well, and this example that you've shared ties back into what you were saying when you go to the networking events and talking about the business and trying to explain what you're doing to people, and then making these connections and then trying to figure out when there's an opening to talk about more personal things like their pets or whatever. I mean, it's all tied together into this kind of bigger picture that you've been sharing with us about the ways that we can navigate difficulties, navigate uncertainty, build connections with each other. What are the things that allowed you to get to this point where you're able to sit here and say, like, there are better ways to live, there are better ways to lead their organizations? Yeah. I love everything you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not something that happened overnight. It's definitely been kind of just a lifetime of working through it, one problem at a time, one space at a time, one concept at a time. And like I said, it's a skill set in so many ways. And so, like, as I mentioned early on, like years ago, I had really bad depression and anxiety. And through a circumstance with like the military moves and the insurance situation, I found myself in a spot where I was kind of cut off from medical help. So I couldn't have a therapist. I couldn't have medication. I couldn't have any of that. And I was just very isolated and not able to get out of bed. And the more I pushed myself and the more I tried to like make it happen, the more it backfired and the more I became more trapped. Like, there was one point where I literally became trapped in my own body. I couldn't move. And that was horrifying. So then I had to just kind of let it go and create space and then just slowly teach myself like a little bit at a time and give myself the grace to forgive myself when I wasn't going as fast as I wanted, forgive myself when I did this 10 times. Why can't I do this today? But then giving myself the space to be like, it's okay. I don't have to win every day. But also keeping that accountability of have to do something. So like, you know, early on when I could like barely get off the couch, it was, I had this app called Super Better, and I'm a sucker for anything gamification. And same. So they would, yeah. So yeah. They'd turn all of these habits into actual little side quests that could give you experience points and stuff. And I remember I was in such a bad point. I was like, I don't know if I can do this. I can't keep up with a whole bunch of tasks and to-dos. And I pull up like one of the first ones, and it was, stand up off the couch, count to six, so stand for 6 seconds, and then sit back down. And then the app like lights up and is like, congratulations, you did it. You did a thing. And I was like, that's it? Like, I can do that. Like, another one was, you know, looking at, you know, pictures of cute animals and babies is healthy for you. So it's like, just hop on the internet for a minute and go look up cute kittens for like 5 minutes. And it was baffling to me because I was so raised in that productivity. I need to be productive. I need to do these good things. But then these small, silly things were being so celebrated by this app. And that actually helped me feel so much better. It helped me find motivation and you know, momentum. And so I realized it doesn't have to be a big win. It doesn't have to be something crazy. You don't have to conquer the whole mountain today. And just holding myself accountable for every day, just do something. Like, that's been so much of my motto, is I don't have to do everything. I just have to do something. And doing a little bit of that over the course of the years, like, it's been, you know, probably more than 15 years of just every day holding myself accountable. And so it's kind of like a sport where you know your moves, you know how to make a goal, you know how to throw the ball, you know all of it. But then going from that into the grief, grief is a very different thing. It's its own beast. And especially that kind of unexpected young age situation. It was, I always called it, it was like going from like college sports to the shitty Olympics. So I was so grateful to myself for learning those skills and practicing over the years and taking them seriously, so that by the time I found myself in that situation, I already knew what I needed to do. And my late husband had already supported me through all that and coached me through all that. And so in that trauma of like missing him and hearing his voice, like that first night I heard, I was waiting for my parents to travel from out of town, and I'm just sitting on that couch and I don't want to move. And I just hear him in my head saying, "You need to eat," because that's something he would say when I was going through the depression or I was going through this and I didn't want to move. And I'd be like, "No, I don't want to." And he's like, "You know the right answer. You need to eat." And I'm like, "You're right. Okay, I agree. You're right. But I don't want to." It's like, and he was always so patient. "You need to eat." And I was like, "Okay, fine." So like, it was that game of like, okay, then I'd order the food and I'd be like, "You need to take a bite." "I don't want to." And then I'd take like two bites. I was like, okay, I did it. I took two bites. I didn't even eat a whole slice of pizza. I just took two bites. But again, that was the win. That was the momentum. That was, I did something. And now I can give myself permission to just sit here on the couch for the next 2 days. It's something that I think doesn't happen instantly. It happens every little day, every tiny step, every small bite, every standing up for 6 seconds or looking at cat videos. Success doesn't always have to look like success. It just has to look like progress.
I mean, truer words were never said, as the saying goes. I mean, I really deeply believe in redefining what success looks like each day, and understanding that doing something, and one of our guests in the past said, doing nothing is doing something.
Yeah.
You know, giving yourself that win to say, I'm doing okay as a human, and whatever I did today was enough, and I'm worthy of love, and I deserve all the good things, and I will make it through these challenges. You know, just recognizing that everything you are doing as a human being is enough.
Exactly. And that was so much of the grief journey too, was, you know, giving myself permission to like, I'm here, I'm existing, and that is plenty. Like, everything else can go away. Everything else can do whatever it needs to do. I'm here, and I did good today.
Yes, I love that. Well, on that note, I want to get into the four questions that I ask every guest, which are related very much to the ways in which you take care of yourself, which you've shared so much about already. But the first question is, what is something that is easy for you to say yes to?
Yeah. So for me, it's funny. I've been listening to your podcast and thinking about these questions. And it's funny, I keep coming back to the thing that's easy to say yes to is a hug. And it's so funny because, like, so since I do have autism and I do have a hard time reading social situations, sometimes when I'm around new people, I can be very stiff and kind of give off that vibe of like, don't touch me. And people get nervous around me and they think, oh, she probably doesn't want to be touched. But I actually am a very physical person. So then when somebody says like, hey, is it okay if I hug you? Like, I instantly relax. I'm like, oh yeah, of course. And like, it breaks all this tension. And I'm like, okay, now I have permission to hug somebody. And like, it kind of breaks the ice whenever I'm uncertain or with new people and I don't know what's going on. It's like, oh yeah, we can have a hug. Like, this is so great. I'll say yes every time.
Hugs are so important. And yeah, I think sometimes it's hard to know, like, is it okay to hug? Especially I go to conferences and I see people I've seen for years on Zoom and I'm like, can I hug you?
Well, it's also a thing too, where I've seen so many times people like doing that calculation of like, can I, should I, like, what should I do? Or maybe not. But when people are brave enough to just ask, like there's Brené Brown has a book where she says clear is kind, and like so many people are scared to ask, but when you just ask, it's like, okay, now we know. And now if it's a no, now you don't have to keep calculating or wondering. But if it's a yes, it's like, cool, now we can just get this hug and we can feel so much better. Like asking is such an easy fix for that. It's so great.
It is great. So then the second question is, what is something that is hard for you to say no to?
Yeah. So what's hard for me to say no to is new ideas. So this is something that comes up all the time with my co-founders, where we are all very engineering minded and design minded, and we're very passionate about like helping people and doing new creative things to like get them what they want. And so we'll go through, oh, this idea and this idea and this feature, and like, oh, this, we can also add this and this and this, and like all these products and ideas. But then, you know, my CEO brain kicks in, or my software engineering brain kicks in. Cause like, even as a software engineer, we'd want to do so many things. Like, wait, let's dial it back to like one thing at a time, keep it simple. And so we'll have these ideas out. And then I take this one idea and I say, okay, we can't do it because this reason, this reason, this reason, this reason, this reason. And I kind of go down this rabbit hole, and they all step back and go, wait a minute, it's not that big of a deal. You didn't go that hard on telling us no. Like, it's okay for you to say you don't like the idea. I'm like, no, the problem is I love the idea, and every part of me wants to do it. That's how far I have to go to convince myself to walk away and focus on what we do need to work on.
Wow. Yeah. I haven't heard that, but that's a good strategy. It's like, I know that I should say no, and I need to give myself some reasons to say no.
And I also, the other thing I always tell myself too, and I tell them as well when we have these conversations, is no for me doesn't mean a hard no. It just means not right now. So it is definitely something I want to circle back to. It's definitely something we should always be thinking about and always be willing to revisit. It's just right now, this thing is a yes, which doesn't create space for this thing. So for lack of space, we have to say no in order to create space for the thing that we do want to prioritize.
Yeah, again, something we can apply not just in our work life or in a project, but everywhere.
Yeah, for sure.
Leave space for the thing that you do want to be doing right now. And it could just be, it's not a no, it's just later.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just not right now.
So the next question then is, when it comes to rest and joy or setting boundaries, taking care of yourself, what are things that you do? What is something that you do really well?
So one thing I do really well is walking away when I'm tired and taking a break. And that is a skill that like I didn't really develop myself. It was more of years and years of, I have this terrible luck that when I'm tired and I force things, I ruin them so bad and break software and other things so bad that I then spend so much more time fixing it than it would have been to just walk away. So with that like bad luck and just kind of forcing me, like, this time will be different. This time I'll push through and I'll be able to do it. It's like, No. I know myself. I know my brain. I can tell I'm tired. I can tell I'm looping in a weird problem in a weird way. Just stop and just walk away. And so I'm really good at like, I'll be so frustrated. Every part of me wants to keep working. And I'm like, I'm going to go take a break. Even if it's just 5 minutes of just like spinning some poi in the backyard, like do something to just reset. And then we can come back and I can spend as long as I want, but I need to walk away. And that's something I've been forcibly very good at.
That's a good skill to have, but one, like you say, I think it develops over time.
Yeah, especially I think the first thing that's really hard for people to develop is that instinct for knowing when you're tired. Because when we're tired and we're in it and we're excited, we're so focused on what we're doing, we're not always dialed into ourselves and what's happening. But I think seeing ourselves when we're in that state is the most important first step to that skill. Because without seeing ourselves and knowing when we hit that line, we can't do the rest of it.
That's a really great point, because I think we're conditioned to say that we should work through fatigue, or we should work through being tired. We should work through not an ideal state, whatever that unideal state is. And it's important to step away and say, no, this is not going to work. And I need a reset, as you were saying. So then where do you still struggle when you think about these kind of same concepts?
So I definitely still struggle with my sense of productivity. So like my family and close friends get like kind of annoyed with me, because at the end of every day, they ask me like, how was your day? How did things do? And my answer is always, well, I didn't get as much done as I wanted to do. And I'm like kicking myself for not getting enough done. And they're constantly coaching me through like, okay, what did you do? And I tell them everything I did. And they're like, you did great. You did all of these things. You did so many things. Stop kicking yourself. Stop being mad at yourself about this. But I'm like, I know, but. And they're like, stop with the buts. You did good. You were productive. Sure, you didn't finish your whole list, but that's okay. And so I'm still working on that. Like, cognitively, I know they're right. I know it's so true, and I need to give myself permission. But it's still a habit that I'm developing and practicing to trust myself and trust that it's okay.
I appreciate you sharing that, because I struggle with doing too much. And over the last couple of years in particular, I've really tried to do less. And I look at some days at my notes, and I'll have 10 or 12 things that are not insignificant that I have done. And then I'll still have a few things that are not done. And I'm just like, man, I didn't get enough done. And yeah. It's on my mind. And now I've started to shift to be like, I did 3 things today. And honestly, that's enough. Like, I did a lot. Exactly. And good job, me.
Exactly. And it's like we were saying earlier about negativity bias. It's like, I got 18 things done. I'm only seeing the 2 I didn't. It's like, wait a minute. No, like, look at the 18. The other 2 can wait till tomorrow. That's a tomorrow problem. That is not a today problem. You did 18. Let's just spend the rest of the night celebrating that and then just relax, because that is awesome.
I love that celebration has come up so much in our conversation today, because it's something that I live my life around celebrating everything, even small things. It's like, it's Tuesday, we should celebrate, you know?
Nice.
But I wish more people took that approach of celebrating their wins at work, celebrating your wins in life, celebrating when you take a stand up for 6 seconds and then sit back down, you know, celebrating all the ways that you can celebrate, because why not be joyful? Why not find that joy in every day when you can? And we know there are days when that's hard, but exactly. making it a habit.
Exactly. And I think it's something that everyone can do too, because part of why I talk about celebration so much is because it's not something that came naturally to me. I'm very analytical. I'm very like negative, biased, and cynical. Like, I need to find all of the flaws and fix them and get down into the root. And it was mostly like my late husband who started me on this journey and showing me and cutting through that noise and then learning myself. So it's not something I learned overnight. Again, it's one of those things I learned over the years. And it is a skill. It is an important thing. It is such a valuable thing to have in our lives. And so even if doesn't come naturally to us, it's worth learning and it's worth taking seriously, because it's not just, I mean, celebration is fun and it's exciting, but it's so important too. And I think we overlook how important it is and how hard it is to learn, but it's so worth it when we learn it.
Agreed. Well, as we wrap up the conversation, the one last question I want to ask of you is, what is something that you are taking away from the conversation today?
Honestly, a lot about celebration. I mean, this whole conversation was so fun, and it was fun talking about, again, like these celebrations and learning and, you know, the nuance of, you know, like how we bring that into the workplace, how we bring that in at home. Yeah, my brain is like, there's so much to take away from it. I can't fix it on one thing. But I think a lot of it dials down to being intentional, being open to learning, being open to forgive ourselves while also holding ourselves accountable in a reasonable way, but also then just being willing to every day just kind of practice something to move us forward and celebrate that move and just be joyful in where we are and trust that we're making progress every day.
Paula, I have so loved having this conversation with you. You just have such great energy. And I mean, for me, the takeaway is joy. Like, you are so joyful to talk to, and you just have this vibrant energy. And also, just, I was thinking matter of fact or something like that, or practical, but I'm like, those words don't really capture it. It's just kind of this very kind of peaceful, even energy. You're like, yeah, we got to practice. We got to celebrate. We do these things, and it makes sense. And I love the way it comes out, and appreciate everything that you have shared on the show today.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. It'll definitely give me awesome energy going into my next adventure. This is great.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you did this and in the break in the chaos, as you were saying at the start of the conversation. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great to be here.
Thanks so much to Paula for this reminder that progress is enough, that celebration is a practice, and that we can design lives and workplaces that expect the unexpected. If this conversation resonated with you, please rate or leave a review and share it with someone who needs permission to take a small step forward today. Keep looking through the turn, and until next time, remember, work is third.